KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Oregon Tradeswoman presentation, My Walk Has Never Been Average, on Friday, September 26th at 7 p.m. My Walk Has Never Been Average is a multimedia presentation based on the lives of women whose stories are rarely told. Adapted for the stage from interviews with Black women in all aspects of construction, these stories reveal great inner strength and accomplishment. That's My Walk Has Never Been Average on Friday, September 26th, 7 p.m. at the Alberta Rose Theater, 3000 Northeast Alberta Street in Portland, Oregon. For more information, that can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Welcome to the Catskill Review of Books, a weekly program interviewing authors, hosted by Ian Williams and produced by Kevin Greff in the hydro-powered studios of WJFF in Jeffersonville, New York.
Hello, this is Ian Williams with the Catskill Review of Books, and this week I'm talking to Jess Bravin about his book, The Terror Courts, Rough Justice at Guantanamo Bay. Jess is the Supreme Court correspondent for the Wall Street Journal, an award-winning one, might I add. Very disturbing, because you lay it out fairly mercilessly what a departure the whole Guantanamo court system was. And it's never quite clear what the motives were. You know, on the one hand, there was a groundswell of, understandable vindictiveness and vengeance. And yet, on the other hand, there was a core of lawyers in the administration who seemed to be determined to amass as much power for the executive as possible and railroad this through almost as a demonstration of imperial presidential power as much as any means of getting justice or retribution. What was your take on the motivation in the end?
I think at the outset in late 2001, when the military commission project was conceived and first drafted in the Bush administration, you're exactly right. It was intended more for its symbolic purpose than to solve a problem or fill a gap in the American justice system. And the reason that that's quite clear to me is that the origin was from the highest councils of the administration and the White House, not from the Department of Justice or the Department of Defense or any of the actual agencies responsible for prosecuting criminals or fighting terrorism or what have you. In fact, the CIA, I discovered when reporting the book, was opposed to the creation of military commissions. Now, their view may be different today, but at the time, they were very comfortable with the U.S. Attorney's Office in Manhattan, the Southern District of New York. They had worked with them before in national security cases. They had relationships with the prosecutors there. They knew the judges who heard those cases, who had security clearances. Nothing of significance had leaked out from those trials that they thought was that they needed to keep secret. So they were very comfortable with the existing relationship. They had no confidence whatever in some new system involving people they'd never heard of and never dealt with, who had no experience in the kinds of clandestine or intelligence matters that they worked with. So even the CIA was uninterested in this, and that helped hobble the military commission project for its first several years and continues to affect the lack of trust there. So there was really nothing, there was no one in the government who had any sort of actual responsibility for fighting terrorism who wanted military commissions. In fact, they were, to a large part, cut out of the process of designing the project at the outset, and it was imposed upon them. And even after it was announced in November 2001 by President Bush, there continued to be efforts by the existing national security establishment to blunt the potential of these military commissions, most notably, to my surprise and perhaps to that of readers, by John Ashcroft, who was then the Attorney General of the United States, not a noted civil libertarian, but someone who had been a state attorney general and someone who had an institutional interest in protecting the purview of the Department of Justice that he headed. And he fought very heavily against creating military commissions and attempted to maintain some control over them if they were going to exist. And then when the first prisoner captured in Afghanistan turned out, to everyone's surprise, to be an American citizen named John Walker Lind, who was designated as detainee number 001. It threw a huge wrench into the project because, for political reasons, non-U.S. citizens were the only people who were permitted to be tried before a military commission. Incidentally, that was the first time that proviso had been included in prior ad hoc military courts. There was no distinctions made on citizenship. But in this one, to avoid any kind of backlash from the Congress over the possibility of Americans facing these kinds of courts, only non-citizens were eligible for trial before them. And then the first person who ends up in custody, who looks by all accounts like an enemy combatant, he's fighting with a force that is fighting the United States military, he turns out to be ineligible for military commissions. And so there's a question of how he's going to be prosecuted and whether the military commission order should be amended. And the Justice Department manages to keep control of that prosecution, as it does with that of a guy named Moussaoui, Zacharias Moussaoui, who was a French citizen who was held in U.S. custody in relation to the 9/11 plot. Again, the Justice Department managed to keep control of his case and prosecute him in federal court rather than surrender him to military commissions. So perhaps a very lengthy answer, but there you see that it really was, at least at the outset, a symbolic policy statement about what kind of posture the United States is going to take and what kind of power its president had in dealing with the enemy, than it was to find some way to prosecute presumably evil people who were too tough for the existing court system.
I thought it was one of the redeeming things for the U.S. military, and with all this background of, well, unabashed torture of prisoners, as the president has now characterized it, and as everybody else was characterizing it, is that the military justice people were actually very stalwart. I thought it was a telling anecdote that the prosecutor's office for the military commissions was relegated to a dungeon in the basement of the Pentagon with only a occasional dial-up connection to the internet and one telephone line. It sort of showed what they thought of the whole thing.
That's absolutely true. I mean, the military legal branches, they were, I would say, most members of the military are politically conservative, but even more than that, they were institutionally conservative, and they have a way of doing things, and for better or for worse, they are committed to doing it in that way. And they were presented with a radical departure from the norms of military justice in the military commissions that were imposed upon them by the Bush administration. In fact, the military legal branches had been on a decades-long effort, really, to upgrade the reputation of military justice after World War II, with the adoption of the Geneva Conventions in the United States, of the what's known as the Uniform Code of Military Justice, and then additional amendments to that in the late 1960s and early 1970s, military lawyers were trying to get their quality of their justice system elevated to gain credibility and to mirror that of the civilian justice system, which, again, for its flaws, is considered a credible system. And so to have a presidential initiative that purported to just wipe away in a brief military order the progress that they thought had been made over decades and decades since World War II and World War I, when it was really a fairly crude and inexact system, was anathema to them, and they didn't want any part of it. I mean, it was amazing to me to have senior military lawyers be able to quote disparaging remarks about military justice that Supreme Court justices had made generations ago, that these critiques still stung them, and they were concerned about the reputation of their system, which they were very proud of. And so to have it dismissed as incapable of dealing with with terrorists or to face the assumption by their political leadership that military officers would simply, as one put it, salute smart and carry out the mission of summarily convicting and punishing people the president designated. That was not their view of their job, and they, to a remarkable extent, on both the prosecution and defense side, and on the judicial side, kept too many of those values. And it was interesting to me as a writer to see that there was almost a core set of legal values that these very straight, very conservative, generally Republican lawyers shared with sort of some of the radical civil liberties groups that were fighting the Bush administration. In several instances, they had more in common with each other than they did with the administration and its political leadership.
This is Ian Williams with the Catskill Review of Books, and this week I'm talking to Jess Brown from the Wall Street Journal about his book, The Terror Courts, Rough Justice at Guantanamo Bay. I do remember at the time of the foundation of the International Criminal Court, I came across a lot of these military lawyers, and they at the time were extremely proud that after the sort of blots of Vietnam, one of their arguments why the US should have an exception from the International Criminal Court was that the military justice system was so rigorous and principled. And of course, one of the effects of the Guantanamo system was to destroy that reputation internationally, wasn't it?
Yes, that was what they were concerned about. They did not want to be tarnished by this politically manipulated system, and they were extraordinarily concerned about it. And in fact, one thing I think we also need to remark upon is that justice has several elements, and certainly the rules on paper are very important, the formal guidelines. But what's also important is the way that individuals carry out those rules. And even though the rules provided for far less fair proceedings than the United States Constitution calls for, or that many international treaties call for, or that many allies of the United States, including the United Kingdom and other countries, demanded, the outcomes of the handful of trials that have taken place are, by and large, you'd have to say the results are certainly not unfair. In many cases, the defendants before military commissions received much more lenient punishments than did United States citizens or foreign citizens, defendants in civilian federal courts who were prosecuted for comparable offenses. And a good example is John Walker Lind. Again, he was the so-called American Taliban who made a plea bargain with federal prosecutors and was sentenced to 20 years in federal prison, which he's still serving. David Hicks was an Australian citizen who was charged with similar offenses before a military commission. He ultimately made a plea bargain that led to him serving an additional year in prison in Australia, and then he was released. So he is now out of jail. More significantly, he's had several legal vindications, mainly based on the legal flaws in the military commission system. But even setting those aside, even accepting that he feels he made a plea bargain because he had no other way to get out of there, he ended up with a much more lenient sentence than a very comparable defendant who had all the protections of the Bill of Rights and the United States Constitution and so on. So that's perhaps I wouldn't say it's purely because these were military lawyers who were so upstanding. I mean, certainly the prosecutors tried to get the toughest sentence they thought they could get away with and so on. But, the outcomes have not been as harsh as the Bush administration hoped for. And in fact, that raises a question of, well, what's the point, now at this stage? Is it, the assumption that many people have is that a military commission would be much harsher in dealing with enemy prisoners. And it turns out, in fact, of the half dozen or so cases we've seen, it has not been harsher.
Yeah. In fact, just as a bit of a digression, I think you probably agree, certainly most Europeans regard American prison sentences in general as barbaric, both in length and in treatment. Several extradition cases have been fought against on the grounds that it would be a cruel and unusual punishment to be sent to prison for trial in an American court, even without the military commissions.
Well, yes. I mean, the American justice system has, it's really, it's more than 50 justice systems, because there's a federal one and the different state ones and so forth. But, it can be very harsh, but it's not considered unfair. In other words, before a court, there are certain guarantees that in terms of access to the evidence against one and challenging jurors who might be unfair, and lengthy appeal system. So in terms of its procedural rights, they're quite extensive in the United States courts, and we can't say it's the only way to do it or necessarily even the best way to do it. But I don't think there's a real serious criticism that it is an unfair system that is, manifestly, unjust. I mean, the whole point of the legal challenges to military commissions is we want to be in a federal court where we can reliably call upon those rights. I mean, that's what they want. The remedy they want is to be before a federal court and to be able to have a full-throated defense the way they could in a federal court, even recognizing that military commissions have been, in practice, more lenient.
Well, one thing that's superior about the military commissions was the availability of defense. I remember at the time of the O.J. Simpson asking a lawyer for a comment on it, and I asked where he'd rather be tried, in Europe or America. And he said, well, if I'm rich and guilty, I want to be tried in America. If I'm poor but innocent, I want to be tried in Europe. And one of the points about the military commission was the quality of the defense that some of these guys got in the military commission. You close the book with, what's his name, the JAG Schwartz, basically procedurally grinding the court down by insisting that the full 87 pages of charges be read for each mm-hmm. defendant. And that defense was provided for free.
Right. Well, this was a stunning development for the Bush administration, which is that they expected that they always anticipated there would be military counsel appointed to represent the defendants, but they expected they would, conceive their role narrowly, and sure, they would try to fight the charges, but they would work within the rule book that was handed to them by their superiors. But instead, what they found were these, by and large, career military lawyers who absolutely fought tooth and nail every conceivable thing they could find about military commissions. They certainly challenged everything in front of the judge or the military commission hearing, but they also challenged their lawfulness in federal court and won before the United States Supreme Court, which shut down the first version of military commissions. And since then, they have been fighting everything they can find about it, because they seem to take quite seriously the duty to provide zealous advocacy for their clients. And that was quite surprising to the political leaders in the Bush administration, not as much of a surprise to the military prosecutors, because in the U.S. military system, their lawyers have to get experience on all sides. They work generally as defense lawyers for a time, as prosecutors for a time, possibly as judges for a time. So they're used to playing all sides, which is not always the case in the civilian system. So that they really threw wrenches in the works at every place they could, partly because they had no respect for this new system, because they were trained in this uniform code of military justice. So you'd never find them challenging the uniform code of military justice as intrinsically unfair and illegal and unconstitutional. Those arguments, one, they probably wouldn't go anywhere, but they're not even raised. Well, in military commissions, they are constantly raised, and you have this unusual spectacle of clean-cut men and women in uniform standing before a flag and cameras and tearing down the military commission system, disparaging it as a blot on American legal tradition. So that certainly helped delegitimize the system in the, I think, view of at least the legal establishment, the broader public. It's hard to tell how much attention they've paid.
Well, it certainly makes them better patriots than your average barroom jingoist, doesn't it?
Well, you know, they would, yeah, I mean, they're taken, you know, certainly 10 years ago, it was even more, you know, courageous to take this act. Now it's par for the course. Now it's just expected. That's what the job is. But yeah, they, and still though, had the Bush administration look carefully at their model case, they should have expected this, because the model they had in mind was a 1942 case of eight Nazi saboteurs who sneaked into the United States, and one of them turned the others in, and they were captured and then tried secretly after after FDR and J. Edgar Hoover feared that how vulnerable the United States actually was to infiltration would come out in a public trial. And they were appointed defense counsel at that time, too, in 1942, you know, less than a year after the Pearl Harbor attacks. And Colonel Kenneth Royale, the chief defense counsel, took the case to the Supreme Court. He fought the military order that FDR had issued as hard as he could. And there's a famous story how he asked permission to appeal to the Supreme Court. He asked the White House for permission, and he got back a message that said, you know, from the White House saying, you know, Colonel, do your duty, which was sufficiently ambiguous to let Colonel Royale believe his duty was to appeal to the Supreme Court. And he did, and he lost.
This was the Supreme Court that legitimized the internment of all Japanese Americans as well.
Correct. That is the same Supreme Court court during wartime, and he did lose that case, but he established. As a legal matter, he did. He didn't lose all the procedural points. He won some of those, or at least left some of them open. History is something that these defense attorneys were extremely steeped in. I mean, they viewed that as the example that they would be held against, and they took it to the wall. You're absolutely right.
This is Ian Williams with the Catskill Review of Books, and today I'm talking to Jess Brabin about his book, The Terror Courts, Rough Justice at Guantanamo Bay. It's very interesting, the history lesson, apart from the 42 Nazi saboteur trial. You even go back to Major Andre, who was not spying. He was there to go and talk to Benedict Arnold, and basically he was hanged as a hostage almost because the British wouldn't hand Benedict Arnold over. This was basically George Washington's say-so, regardless of everybody else.
Yes. Now, this is a case that goes back to the American Revolutionary War, and it was often cited by the Bush administration to represent the grand tradition of military tribunals prosecuting enemy combatants outside of normal legal channels. And so it was often reminded, and if it was good enough for George Washington, why wouldn't it be good enough for us? And but the story of that case, as you mentioned, was, you know, somewhat more convoluted than that. This was a trial that took place before the adoption of the United States Constitution, before there was a U.S. Congress to enact statutes. There was a Continental Congress, it is really an exception to the way that most enemy spies and saboteurs were handled by the Continental Army, as it was called during the Revolution. It really was a part of this high level chess game over Benedict Arnold, the American general who went over to the British, and Major Andre was Benedict Arnold's handler, you might say, from the British side. And when the Americans captured him, they wanted to trade him for Benedict Arnold. And when I guess it was General Howe. I don't know.
General Howe it was, yes. Sir.
Yeah. When he refused to do that, then General Washington had basically a 1-day hearing before a board of military officers, and then hanged Major Andre.
It's interesting. It wasn't even a popular decision in the Continental Army at the time. Well, for of course, it established a fairly gruesome precedent if any of them fell into the hands of the British, both sides had been fairly gentlemanly.
Well, I think the British did hang Nathan Hale first,
yes.
the young man from Yale College who famously said, "My only regret is I have but one life to give for my country." And I guess the British response was, "Okay, we'll take it," and they did. So he was hanged also in a fairly summary fashion, but both of those, I believe, were relative exceptions. The more common way to deal with enemy spies was to have a more conventional trial, and there wasn't as much intervention. But even regardless of the exact procedures used during that war, military law, as has law in general, has evolved considerably in the past several centuries. For example, the United States Constitution being one important development since then, and in terms of military law, the Geneva Conventions and the Uniform Code of Military Justice and international treaties, Universal Declaration of Human Rights, and these things which all inform, if not always control, the outcome of a judicial proceeding. And I don't think that there is, there would be much support for using the system that General Washington made up on the spot in trying to deal with Benedict Arnold.
Well, it's interesting on that sort of ideological front. In the early days, you were mentioning the way that the administration was fighting off attempts to incorporate the latest developments in international law in terms of crimes against humanity and war crimes, because they didn't want to legitimize international law in case it came back to bite them on the backside.
Yes, there was a real ideological component. I mean, there were a number of legal scholars who were I would say on the relative fringes of the academy, who had high powered positions in the Bush administration, which had the effect of taking quite extreme views that were not widely accepted and making them the official policy of the United States, and in some cases effectively the law of the United States, because opinions from the Justice Department Office of Legal Counsel and certain other parts of the government were treated as binding law by the Executive Department of the United States, and often there was no way to question or challenge them because they were secret. So they were the rules. And interestingly, they were secret not only from the public, but also from the military personnel assigned to carry out military commissions. There were many questions that came up from the lawyers on both the prosecution and defense side about how are we supposed to deal with this situation or that situation? What is the binding law? Does a convention against torture apply, for instance? Does this apply? What is the right way to deal with this type of evidence, and so on? And they were given very ambiguous answers by the civilian leadership. And it turns out that in many cases, they did have answers. They were just kept secret in these secret memos, many of which have since been released publicly. So it was almost as if they were afraid that if people could see what they thought the law was, there would be such immediate disagreement and criticism and explanation of their errors that their policy would disappear. And that is, in fact, what took place, because once those memos were disclosed in some of them in our newspaper and other by other news organizations in this country and abroad, they were withdrawn and canceled by first the Bush administration and the Obama administration. So,
well, Jesse, I'm afraid that's all we have time for now. That's been great. This is Ian Williams with the Catskill Review of Books. And this week I've been talking to Jess Bravin about the Terror Courts, Rough Justice at Guantanamo Bay. Fascinating excursion into military legal history. Thanks, Jess.
My pleasure, Ian.
Thank you. KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the PDX People's Climate March on Sunday, September 21st. Gathering will begin at 3 p.m. at the Park Bowl of Tomacole Waterfront, just south of the Hawthorne Bridge. World leaders are gathering in New York City for a UN summit on climate change, and across the country, people will be out in the streets to demand a better world for ourselves and for generations to come. Again, that's the People's Climate March on Sunday, September 21st at 3 p.m. at Tomacole Waterfront Park in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Mass incarceration is the barometer, the indicator of mass injustice in a society. BPs are those in every land, throughout every era, who were in prison for fighting mass injustice. It is no different today regarding mass incarceration of BPs in the U.S. They must be freed.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Portland Poetic Hip Hop Day of Action for former Black Panther and political prisoner Sundiata Okoli on Monday, September 22nd at Anjoni Restaurant in Portland. There will be a writing workshop from 5 to 6 p.m. and a poetry reading open mic from 7 to 8:30 p.m. based on Sundiata's writing prompt. Featured speakers include Rochelle Radizi Hart, Black Butterfly, Walida Imarisha, Ajamu Umi, and more. Again, that's the Portland Poetic Hip Hop Day of Action for Sundiata Okoli on Monday, September 22nd at Anjoni Restaurant, 910 North Killingsworth Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events. Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the final La Peña Flamenca de Portland of the season, on September 26th at the Steep and Thorny Way to Heaven. La Peña Flamenca de Portland presents Berto Boyd with Daniel Azcarate and Elena Villa. There will be two performances, one beginning at 7 p.m. and the other at